We're back on the Rule of Three. Tim Slagle over in the Chicagoland area, and up in the North Country, Mr. Brian Miller.
Yes, recently returned from the South Country. Quite glad to be back in the North Country.
Wow, you drove right by me.
I do. I drove under you. We went through Missouri.
Let's save that for segment three.
That's a tease. That's what they call that in the radio biz.
Well, yeah, and we're also in the second segment. We're going to be discussing the movie we didn't get around to last week.
Yeah, so, it's yet another tease. It's like Inception. It's like Christopher Nolan's folding stories into stories. Is this even a real podcast, or is it just a dream? I don't know.
I actually fell asleep during Inception.
Ironic.
Yeah. Well, I thought you were supposed to. I thought it was part of that. So you wake up at an unspecified point in the movie and don't know what the heck is going on. and then silly me, I rewound it because I said, I've lost my place. If I rewind it and start it over, where I dozed off, I'll figure it out. And no.
Falling asleep during Inception that's the version of like watching that in 3D.
Yeah, it's like sense around.
The sleepiness comes right out of the screen. Yeah, like Smell-O-Vision or whatever they had for a while.
Yeah, John Waters did that for Hairspray. No, not Hairspray. I can't remember which one. But they actually had cards that they handed out.
Oh.
And it was scratch and sniff cards, and they would flash numbers at the bottom of the screen, and you were supposed to scratch the number and sniff it.
I can't think of someone whose movies I'd want to smell less.
And they would play jokes. They would play jokes too. It was just like when there's with the 3D, especially in the early days, they'd have to find like a big long pole.
Oh yeah, or somebody just reaches their hand needlessly out toward the thing.
Yeah, or in a House of Wax. I loved the film, but I always watched it on TV. And there's the scene where there's a guy with the paddle balls.
Of course.
In front of the wax museum, just smacking them for like 5 minutes. And it's like, what the hell? And then I found out it was a 3D film, and I went, oh.
It's funny you say that. I just watched Jaws 3 the other night on Netflix because my wife had never seen it. And that's the one that's in 3D. And it is an atrocity. Like, even if it wasn't 3D, it's the worst.
There's there was a John Holmes film.
I saw Disco Girls and Hot Skin. I've seen it in the movie theater.
Did you?
Yep. They used to run it at the right across the street from the Biograph Theater in Chicago.
I never wanted to see that because I imagine what they did in that one.
Well, you know, you're right. It's funny. They kind of just do it like a regular bad 3D movie for quite a while, and they don't do what you think they're going to do. And then the money shot of the movie, as it were, is old Johnny pointed at the camera. And when I saw
I know. There's no way.
Right.
There's no way you could do that film without doing that.
Right.
Especially in that era of the 3D.
Yeah. And so the theater was packed. It was full of DePaul students. It was, right by the college. And everybody ducked to one side instinctively. And I always said, if you wanted to find out who you should date, you should find the girl who just sat straight up. Just didn't move. She's a trooper.
So that's what they would do. They would do like little gags like that on the audience. Somebody would come in with flowers, like a thing of flowers, and then number 14 would flash on the screen. And then like 2 seconds later, she'd let one rip. And it's like, it's too late. You already scratched it. You know what I mean? You already wanted to smell the flowers. And
yep, that sounds like John Waters.
Yep.
Speaking of it, Danny, before we get too far off, you've got a prediction. You have a prediction to make?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry.
This was a very worthy diversion, trust me. But I want to get to your prediction because it's
my my prediction is that is President Trump. Is after the incidents that occurred this weekend between Hillary referring to half of Trump's supporters as a basket of deplorables.
Which I will break down that phrase. Remind me to break down that phrase and why it doesn't work comedically. I explained it to my wife and she's like, they really need a comedian on staff.
Between that And the header she took at the during the 9/11 memorial, I mean, that was actually a bigger story than the actual 15-year, you know, look back. I was going to make a sick joke there. I better stop.
Oh, I was going to say, there's a certain parallelism.
Well, it occurred to me that that all the service dogs that were used to locate survivors in the wreckage probably have all passed their prime and are actually probably at the Rainbow Bridge. And when Hillary was being carried to the van, it looked like she was ready for the Rainbow Bridge as well.
It looked rough, but it was a very bad week for her. I would say it was definitely the worst week of the campaign for her by a factor of many.
Yeah, yeah. It will be surprising if Trump is not leading in all the polls when this reflects in the polls.
I think that's conventional wisdom, but at the same time, I do wonder if Trump has a very fixed floor and a very fixed ceiling.
It is possible.
This will tell. Next week's polls will tell that, I think.
But also there's something going on with Trump that is not really mentioned, is that there's a lot of support for Trump that nobody will admit to anybody.
Yes.
You know, granted, I saw a couple senior citizens in the grocery store wearing Make America Great Again hats. And they were so proud to have those red hats. And it was almost heartwarming and touching to see the big grins on their faces, because it looked like the tats just came in the mail. And they were so excited to have those hats.
Well, there's a tease for segment three. I got a story about that. Well, man, this is getting too tangled up. This is postmodern. But so you want to call the election. I mean,
I think what I was going to say is there's a lot of support for Trump that just. Even when the pollsters call and they say, who are you supporting? It's like, I'm still undecided. I think, you know, even that anonymity of a poll, I think people are embarrassed to admit that they're supporting Trump.
But because he's embarrassing.
But pardon?
Because he's embarrassing.
Sure. Of course he is. Of course he is. There's no question that he is. However, when someone looks down their nose and says, oh, the supporters are deplorable, it's like, yes, I am. We are the deplorables.
That's a galvanizing thing.
It is the most unifying thing that has ever occurred in this campaign.
Compared rightly in a way to Mitt Romney's comment of the 47%, you just never – why would you ever slag on a group of voters? It's just never – there's no good – there's no angle on that.
Well, you know, it's for the same reason that a comic says let's give it up for the troops is basically
– Yeah.
She was at a LGBTQ meeting, I believe, when she said it. And it was like she knew it was a clap break. It was a guaranteed clap break.
Oh, we all know there's certain jokes that you can do, say, at Acme that are a guaranteed applause break that people at the bar in rural Wisconsin will hate, and vice versa.
Right.
But like, you know, it's like from a campaign perspective, you're not playing to the bar or the club. You're playing to the TV.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people inside the closer you get inside the Hillary circle, mm-hmm. I think the more people have a tendency to not be numb to how they're being perceived. Is that there's such a, you know, it's like being inside Michael Jackson's inner circle, you know. It's like, I'm just going to sleep with this beautiful little boy tonight, this little beautiful little cancer boy tonight. It's like, oh, okay, Michael, sure.
Yeah, that'll cure him right up. Linguistically, by the way, if anyone's wondering, the reason basket of deplorables doesn't work is that basket and deplorables are both kind of weird words to use when you're grouping people. Either word would be the weird word in the phrase. So you could say bunch of deplorables. And so now the bunch is easy, so we're focusing on deplorable. That's like our little – that's the spice that makes it weird. Or you – which is still not a good word because deplorables, nobody says that. But then basket is also weird because you would not keep deplorables in a basket. So you could say like basket of racists.
You must have seen the movie Basket Case.
I have seen the movie Basket Case.
That is definitely
too.
A basket full of deplorable.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
that's the image it created for me. But is it a murder of deplorables?
a gander. So real quick, I still think Hillary's going to win.
Congress of deplorables. Now that one works.
Yeah, that one works. I think you hit on the nail on the head. Real quick before the segment's over, I still think Hillary's going to win. I think because of her ground game, and I think because Trump just has going to have a dysfunctional mechanism, and that stuff can be undervalued. But what do you want to put a little like? What's a friendly wager?
You know what? I never thought of a friendly wager.
Tell you what, let's think of a friendly wager and we'll do a segment on it next week.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I like that. Cool. Back for the next segment.
And we're back on the Rule of Three. Tim Slagle, Brian Miller. And in case you listened last week,
which we assume you did,
yeah. In case you're one of the lucky 13,
that's the name of my fan club.
You know that we actually did our first teaser. We were talking about movies, and the movie we talked about last week was Deadpool, and that actually surprisingly filled up the entire segment.
I think we had more content on Deadpool to fill the time than Deadpool had to fill its time.
Yeah, we did not expect that. I had watched two DVDs last week. Deadpool was one of them. And the other one is Brian and I were talking about. I think it's the only film. I think we're the only two people that thought that film was fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was a huge fan. I mean, I would, you know, it's not their best, but it's. It's very, very good.
I would disagree. I would put it up there.
And we're talking, by the way. I think you. I don't know
oh,
if you bear,
oh gosh, I'm sorry. Yes, we haven't. We're still teasing it, aren't we?
Yes. So much tease in this episode.
Okay. Well. The they should be the clue. Of course, we're talking about the Coen brothers.
Yes, and Hail Caesar.
Well, it could be the brothers Duffer now too.
That's true.
Got that right? The Duffer brothers.
Yes.
But the Coen brothers, who are we talking about? The movie is Hail Caesar. I talked right over you. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I just wanted to make sure we got the title in there. This movie came and went in, spring, I think?
I think it was almost a year ago.
Was it that long ago?
I remember going to the theater and seeing a promo for it. It's like, Hail Caesar. It's another Coen brothers film coming out. I might want to remember that. I thought it was a Thanksgiving film.
It might have been. It's been a little while, and it just came and went real quietly. Nobody seemed to care about it, and I felt like people didn't appreciate what they were going for in a way, because people were like, it was flimsy and it didn't really have a story, and it's like, yeah, it wasn't supposed to be a big story.
I don't know if you've noticed this, but. None of the Coen brothers films really have much of a story.
It's literally the joke in The Big Lebowski is that there was never a story.
Yeah.
That's like the premise, that's the whole turn of the movie.
Yeah, that's exactly. It was Inside Llewyn Davis. They threw in the cat subplot because they realized when the film was nearing completion that it didn't have a plot. It was just scenes from the life of a folk singer that there was absolutely no plot in there. So they said, okay, how about a cat?
Right. And you know, I mean, I think what's interesting too is the Coens are genuinely nihilistic, I think. I think they genuinely believe in like the void and like true sort of existential emptiness, which is it's a tricky thing as a writer if that's a message you want to convey. It inherently to provide a traditional narrative payoff is to support the idea that things come together or happen for a reason. And so the Coens, I think, are always confounding that because their whole point, I think made probably best in A Serious Man, which I love, is that there's not a point and it doesn't come together.
Huh. Interesting.
I think if there's one overriding idea that pervades the Coen brothers movies is that we're all trying to make order out of chaos and find meaning in chaos that is truly chaotic and nothing comes together and it just ends. But that's kind of funny to them.
Yeah. For those who have not seen the film, the best description I can make of it is that it is just a sentimental Valentine to Hollywood in the 50s.
Yeah, and almost really a sketch movie as opposed to a traditional film. I mean, it's a series of sketches.
Right.
Be it this kind of straight-up comedy sketch scene when they bring
in...
Well, there is kind of a cat.
They
find some through lines, of course, in the little romance between...
There is kind of a cat that's somewhat irrelevant that just barely holds stitches the scenes together. But the scenes are just magnificent. I mean, never have you seen since that time such masterful pieces of Hollywood musicals done again.
Right. What my theory on this movie, and I the Coens never do interviews, so I haven't seen if they said this out loud, but I think people kind of missed the point of it too, where they made some really serious movies of late, No Country for Old Men, and they can do that, but those guys like to have fun, and I think they wanted to make a fun movie, and I think they wanted to be able to do all the different kinds of movies they would never get around to. They're probably never going to make a full on traditional musical. They're never going to make a World War II
even though I might say Oh Brother came pretty close.
Yes, but I mean I'm talking about an old fashioned kind of Hollywood, old style musical, or like a war movie like with the submarine. They're probably never going to make a World War II movie. And so this let them what would a Coen Brothers submarine movie look like, and what would a Coen Brothers wartime musical look like, and what would a Coen Brothers gladiator movie look like? It's like they realize they're never going to get to be able to make all these different kinds of movies that they want, and so this was their way to kind of dabble in it and then sort of show what they would do.
Interesting. I think the reason why the film suffered, and this is my opinion, and it comes from my political slant, is that the Coen brothers didn't treat the communist writers of the 50s reverently.
No, they do. I thought that was actually kind of hilarious about that.
Oh, so do I.
I loved that.
It was hilarious. But you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to treat them as warriors and martyrs and revolutionaries, and they kind of made them seem a little goofy.
I mean, that might have been why. That might have been why I didn't go with Hollywood. But I don't think Joe Blow movie viewgoer cares whatsoever. I think it didn't work because people went thinking they're going to see a lot of George Clooney being funny, and he was great. But most of the movie is old. Eddie Mannix, of course, a real person, a real Hollywood fixer for MGM, the most famous Hollywood fixer.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and really, I love the Blacklist stuff. Thing that bothered me more was that Eddie Mannix in real life was a real jerk, beat his wife up and did some really terrible stuff, and they kind of, to make him the super moral character bugged me a little bit. I don't think they were actually saying it. It was a very fictionalized version of it, but Josh Brolin was very good in it, but I don't think people expected it was going to be I think the Coens, maybe they underestimated. People don't like old movies. Like, most people have no interest in seeing a movie made before 1970. I love old movies, but if you don't love old movies, that movie is pretty ambly.
That could be the reason. Yeah, it amazes me when I talk to the nieces and nephews when they say, "Oh yeah, I like old movies." Edward Scissorhands is one of my favorites.
Which, I mean, at a certain point, if I think about, say, in the early 90s when I would have started to watch movies, to me, Taxi Driver was that. Well, that wasn't old, but it was older. Well, that was only 15 years old. 15, 20 years ago, Edward Scissorhands got made.
Black and white. Did you know that? The kids can't handle black and white at all.
No, I would think the Instagram filter generation would come back around on that in a weird way. It seems like black and whites come back around. But no, I know people who's like, the idea of watching a black and white movie is the way I feel about watching a silent movie.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly it. Is that when you see the wild gesticulation that they use to convey things in the silent film, it's just an immediate turnoff. It's like, oh, God, I can't stand this.
Yeah,
and that's what kids today, when they turn – the kids today – when they turn on a movie that that has no color, that's what they see automatically, and they don't. They're not. You're just like, you know, I could never appreciate pantomime. They cannot appreciate shadow.
No, which I find a little bit weird. Like I said, because with the Instagram filter thing coming around, although it makes me wonder what. You know, in 70 years, will people be like, remember when those movies didn't physically reach out and rub your genitals during the whole thing? God, they were so hard to watch without that weird hologram hand that gently strokes you while you watch the movie. It's like, I just get bored.
And and this time, the segment ended just a little too late. I just don't know what you have to expect.
Final segment here of Rule of Three. We're recording this a day slightly later than usual because I have been in old Kentucky and also extreme Southern Illinois. Extreme Southern Illinois makes it sound like they're really super into being from Southern Illinois, like they're like a metal band. I just mean that's like really far south.
Southern Illinois is Kentucky.
Yeah, it is.
If you haven't been there, you don't know. But it still sounds like Illinois. But if you've been there, you know it's Kentucky.
Yeah, it's like people, and a lot of people think of Southern Illinois and they think, oh, Champaign-Urbana. No, that's Central Illinois. That's a very different thing, too.
It's almost somewhat Northern Illinois.
I agree. I mean, I think of Central as almost like Effingham and Mount Vernon. But, I mean, Southern Illinois is, you know, Metropolis and Cairo would be the farthest point. But Illinois has got that little reservoir tip that people forget about at the bottom that kind of pokes into Kentucky and Tennessee. And I grew up on the banks of the Ohio River, so I was born in Kentucky, lived on the other side of the river in what was basically a suburb of Paducah, Kentucky.
And there's coal mines there, so I mean you can't get more Appalachian than coal mining.
Absolutely. No, it's a very – and in fact, Southern Illinois fought for the South in the Civil War. Which I think a lot of people kind of forget about or conveniently ignore when they're like, Lincoln was from here. <It's> like, yeah, well, I mean, there's that, but, but you know, so I went down for my grandma's 90th birthday. I had a couple of days to kill before the party. So I was visiting people and hanging around, and I went from uptown Minneapolis, which is about as blue as it gets, to red state Southern Illinois, and I found the reddest place in Southern Illinois at one given moment, which is I went to a 2 p.m. matinee showing on a Friday afternoon of the movie Sully, which is a movie made by a 90-year-old white guy about a 70-year-old white guy about how awesome old white guys are. And Sully is awesome. And it was a good movie.
Yeah. A 90-year-old white guy played by a 70-year-old played by a 50-year-old white guy.
Yeah. Exactly. I walked in the movie. Well, I actually sneaked into the movie, which I'd never done before. Not into the theater. I didn't theater hop. I mean, there was nobody at the front. There was nobody at the front desk. They had some poor girl who was like doing the projectors and selling the popcorn and doing the tickets. And she like John Cleese in that Fawlty Towers and nobody's there. And she's trying to be a full staff. Or Bugs Bunny playing baseball against himself and playing all the positions. And I was late for the movie. And finally I was like, you know, they only won.
Go back there a minute. Now, why was this?
Because it's a really small town. And it was a matinee.
It was a matinee in a very small town. Okay.
Yeah, and so it was just this teenage girl just running around, and I didn't have any small change, just leave on the counter.
Was this a multiplex, or was it just like a okay?
Eight screen theater.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an AMC theater, which is usually a little more crisply run in my experience.
Wow, if there's any CEOs looking for potential hires, that's running eight screens, the popcorn machine, and box office.
Oh yeah, she needed like Shiva's arms or something like that, man. She needed like or Vishnu or whatever. She needed the like, extra arms. She was running all around, and I felt bad, and I wasn't trying to put one over on her, but she was just too besieged to get to the ticket desk, and I was standing there, and finally there was a guy waiting behind me, and finally I just said, all right, whatever. And I just went into the movie, and the guy looked at me like I was like, he couldn't believe it. And then he got this grin on his face, and he ran through the thing. And he gave me a big thumbs up like I was Spartacus or something. So went into the scene of the movie. It was already dark because I was a little bit late. I sat down. I watched the movie. The lights go up. I turn around, and I was like, oh, my God, I found out where all the Trump hats are going. They're going to this room. It was just a sea of red hats. And then I was like, of course, it's a 2 p.m. showing of this movie during the week. Like, everybody there was – I was throwing off the age curve by a solid 60 years. I mean, it was something else.
And that's – yeah, and that's – you know, that's the Trumpets. That's a great movie for the Trumpets. You know? You know what I mean? Because it's a guy that defies the government and is a hero. Is yet he looks like he's taken as a – everyone thinks that Sully was a hero except for the FAA.
How much did they exaggerate that in the movie, I wonder? Did the FAA really get after him?
I don't know.
They turn them into like these snarling villains, but it seemed to me pretty Hollywoodized. It's sure. Funny because usually in Hollywood movies – the talky parts are pretty accurate, and then the big stunt is like way overblown. And in this case, the talking was way overblown, and then the big stunt was exactly real. You're like, holy smokes, no, he really did that.
Huh.
It's a pretty good movie, but it made me think of like it's hard to know in some ways who's doing well in any election or whatever. It can be, I think, because I'm in Minneapolis. I'm around, for the most part, one group of people. Or I go over to I'm in Southern Illinois, and it's like nobody there could conceive of voting for anybody but Trump.
Well, there's a classic story by what's his name? The guy who was in the news, Goldberg, I think is his name. He wrote it in a book, and I forget the person he was talking about. But it was like at a cocktail party on the East Coast. Shortly after the Nixon won by a landslide.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I don't know how that's possible. I don't know anyone who voted for him.
Yeah. But I think that's true.
It's that she was in such a the journalist circle in which she hung out was, of course, they were all, you know, they were all McGovern. They were all McGovern people.
Yeah.
And she just assumed that McGovern was going to do really well. And when the country just swept red, I don't even think they called it red back then. But when the country swept red, they were aghast.
Yeah, and if you're hanging out in a Berkeley enclave, or if you're at a hunting shack in Arkansas, you're probably hanging out with 90% of the people who agree with you, and so you just sort of assume you get these kind of closed loops a little bit. You can easily do that now with media filters and stuff. If you only go to certain sites, or you set your Google News so you only hear about this or that.
That's a big problem. I mean, that's why the electorate is so polarized today, is because people now have their own, the news is now biased. There is no unbiased news.
No, there really isn't.
People listen to one or the other and think that the other side is just a bunch of propaganda. It's been my contention for the longest time that you've got to listen to news from the bias that you disagree with, because in between, those polls is where the truth lives.
Right. And I even find it – I do that intentionally. I mean, I'm on a conservative show for a couple hours a week at least. I try to listen to different stuff. And sometimes I still find it difficult because I go, well, the guys on the right make an interesting point, but then they have such different information. The guys on the left make an interesting point. They've got different information. And sometimes I don't even know if the middle – sometimes you're like, I don't even know where the middle is on that.
Yeah, and they've done such a good job, and both sides have done such a good job of convincing you that the other side is lying.
Right, and it becomes, yeah, like I said, there's no, there's really not that, you need that up-the-middle kind of baseline news to get it. It's really hard to find.
I think in the early days, I think it was more distinct. newspapers right on the, they named themselves by their party.
Right. The, my know, hometown the, paper is the Marion Daily Republican. It's like, okay.
Yeah, exactly. There it is right there. Right up at the top. Okay. It's I think we need to go back to that. There's actually a paper. There's actually a paper in Quincy, Illinois.
Oh, I know Quincy.
Called The Whig.
Wow.
The Daily Whig.
That's a throwback.
Yeah, I know. That's an old newspaper.
Which also probably gives it a whole new meaning when you hold it over your head in the rain.
And
speaking of new, I think the news. I think the hot news is this segment is.
I can't find a clever way out, but I think that was the last line of the segment. So,
well, we wrapped up multiple teases in this episode, so we only got like five more left to untangle in the next one.
Yeah, it's well, we got the bet.
We got the bet. We'll have to figure out the terms of the bet. Something silly. Speaking of which, by the way, we have a couple of friends who bet pretty high stakes in terms of embarrassment and personal humiliation on football every year. And when Teddy Bridgewater, the Vikings quarterback, hurt his knee, it looked like one of our friends was in dire trouble. but they won their first game, so we'll see. But
did he bet again?
Oh, yeah, there's a bet, and it's big.
I think that might be a segment.
I think that should be a segment.
I think we're teasing a segment.
There we go. Well, I bet we'll be back next week with three more segments, probably all interrelated again.
And TimSlegel.com, Brian Miller with a .com.
Yep, Brian Miller with a Brian Miller Comedy.com, and Real Brian Miller on Twitter. And I think that's about it.
Catch the podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends about it. Share it on Facebook.
Yes.
See you next week.
See you next week.